Welcome to the Victory Show.
Welcome to the Victory Podcast. This is Travis Cody, and today I am thrilled to introduce a guest who has been at the forefront of innovation and entrepreneurship for decades, Lance Cottrell. Lance is a visionary technologist, entrepreneur, and investor who has spent his career pushing boundaries and solving problems at the highest levels. He was the founder of Anonymizer, which was a pioneer in online privacy, created groundbreaking solutions that protected millions of users worldwide. His influence extends beyond technology, as now he's a much sought-after advisor. He's an angel investor and the driving force behind Feel the Boot. It's a podcast and also a website and a program where he provides invaluable resources and mentoring to help startup founders navigate the complex world of entrepreneurship. Lance's expertise spans cybersecurity, privacy, startup development, but what really sets him apart is his passion for empowering others to succeed. His insights are informed by firsthand experience, having built companies, exited companies, led teams, and innovated at the cutting edge of tech. So get ready to learn, be inspired, and hear stories from a man who combines deep technical knowledge with a clear vision for what it takes to thrive in today's ever-evolving business landscape. Lance, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much. It's my pleasure. Great to be here.
So what I find fascinating is with Anonymizer is when you built that and going. So let's talk about the year that got started.
Yeah. So I started Anonymizer in 1995. So that was pretty early. And that sprung out of some open source work. I was launched a couple of open source projects building anonymous email systems back in 1993.
Wow. So what's fascinating is I don't even think that most people knew what the internet was in 1995, and you were already working on privacy protections.
You're not wrong. And fortunately, it gave me some time to work out what I was doing on the business side of things when there was absolutely no competition. I'd go out and say, hey, you need to think about, privacy on the internet and on the World Wide Web. And people would say, tell me about this World Wide Web thing. So I had some time because I went directly from a PhD in astrophysics to starting the company. So seriously didn't know what I was doing. But it is why I started that early, right? Because the web and the internet were really built for science and research.
Academic, to begin with.
I had a workstation on my desk directly connected to the backbone of the internet starting in 1991. And, was setting up websites for my research group on the very first version of CERN Server 1.0, which was the first web server. So I had access to that awareness of what was going on the internet way ahead of, I think, most people.
Yeah. What's funny is 1995, I was a senior in high school and I did a research paper on virtual reality. And I remember getting the paper back and on the top of it, my English professor had written, "Congratulations, in 25 years of teaching English, this is the first time someone's done a paper on a topic I've never heard of before." And so when we had to do our reports on that, I got up and was talking about it. People's eyes are glazing over. They don't know what I'm talking about. And I was like, internet, is anybody internet? And some guy was like, I saw that in a movie. That was it. Nobody even knew. And I'm like, oh man, like nobody even knows. And like, this is coming. So that's,
I really wanted to do that too. I was thinking about virtual reality and augmented reality and looking at ways of exploiting that. I even had a domain name tied to it. I owned there.com. Be there, go there, I'll see you there.com. Would have sold itself, but
I was going to say, I wish I would have kept that one.
I should have. I finally sold it off. But man.
So what was that pivot like going from astrophysics into web? Was it just because you didn't have a solution and you needed it for yourself, so you just kind of built it?
Less that than I'd started building these privacy tools on the side. And I think the political context is important here, that this was when the FBI was launching something called the Clipper chip. And the idea was that privacy and cryptography were important. We needed security. And so the government would create this chip that could go in every computer that would provide really strong privacy, and they'd keep a copy of all the keys. And I thought that's not a great idea for many, many reasons. And so I got involved with a group called the Cypherpunks. And so in my spare time while I was doing the astrophysics, I was building cryptographic tools and internet privacy systems and releasing them open source. And that rapidly became more interesting and exciting to me than the thesis I was working on. Also, it turns out that the Hubble Space Telescope wasn't big enough. I had a 100-hour observation on one object, and the data was barely usable. I really couldn't answer this question I was trying to get at about structure formation in the early universe. And in the meantime, like there was an article about this open source tool in the New York Times and thousands and tens of thousands of people using it. And I said, but it wasn't easy to use. You know, it was by hackers for hackers. You know, the first instruction is go run this make file on your Unix workstation, which sort of ruled my mother out as a potential user. So I said, okay, I want to democratize this. This is clearly a need. I see this is something that's important. I'm passionate about it. And so, yeah, I just sort of put the PhD on what turned out to be permanent hold. Other really brilliant idea was to start a company with the idea of finishing a PhD in physics in my spare time. No,
I
didn't
just
happen.
had someone on last week, and she was medical doctor. She was in gone through medical school, was in residency, and started getting offered leadership opportunities and realized, okay, medicine isn't for me. I really want to become management. And so while she was in residency, she started her master's program.
Yeah,
Second time.
those are some crazy
You
decisions.
overachievers, I mean, my God, my brain hurts just listening to that.
Well, to be fair, mine never got finished because, you know, starting a company is all encompassing. Once you jump in, it just takes over your life for the next many, many years.
So let's talk about like starting basically out of your bedroom. What was the sort of the growth of the company? And when you started it, did you have a vision for what you wanted it to become? Or did you just go, this seems like a good idea. I see the trend is coming. Let's go this way and see what happens.
Yeah, so I absolutely knew that I wanted to do something around internet privacy and anonymity. That was sort of my core focus, but I didn't really know where to find that and how to manage that. So I ended up building a company that could bootstrap for a while. And so this was super early days. So we sold dial-up. I did web hosting. I had a small effort in banner advertising. You know, we tried a bunch of different things as revenue streams while we sought out the right answer around privacy. And then eventually was able to work with someone who built a little bit of tech, acquired that, and that was the core of Anonymizer focused on web-based privacy. And that started to grow pretty fast. Once I got that up and running and could market it and had, you know, running on fast servers and whatnot, that exploded pretty quickly and got a lot of attention and took over the whole company. And that's really what I wanted to do. But it kind of hit a limit. We couldn't cross the chasm with it because I think it appealed to a particular category of user, people who were concerned about privacy, a little bit paranoid about what was going on, and willing to take some inconvenience to have this security. But most people would trade a huge amount of privacy for a $5 coupon on some website. And so trying to move past that initial audience, we got maybe 1 million active users, 100,000 paying subscribers, and it began to be pushing on a rope. And so we ended up discovering a new market and pivoting into that. And that's where things really took off. And that was after surviving the dot-com collapse in 2000, and shortly after 9/11 is when we discovered the new market.
What was the new market?
The new market was in the government. And so, as it turned out, one day we were getting subpoenaed by the local FBI cybercrime department in San Diego, as we did fairly regularly. You run an anonymity service, people do bad things with it. But
Attract
this
some
particular
attention back then.
Yeah, right. But this particular time, we got to talking with them about, you know, what we did, why we did it, the importance of anonymity, and how easy it was to identify people. And we started to ask them, well, if you're going after some bad guy online, you don't want them to know that you're coming from FBI.gov or whatever. How do you hide? And they more or less said that, on the whole, they didn't think many people were paying attention, but if they did, you know, they usually would use the Wi-Fi at the Starbucks down the street or something like that and say, we need
Super
to talk.
technical FBI strategy.
Oh man, it was early days. Everyone assumes that they were doing these amazing things, but really not. And so we went down, taught them about kind of how we understood privacy. They became our first customer. And within like 2-3 years, government, particularly the intelligence and national security community, was 90% of our business. It just exploded. That was when we found that product market fit.
And then who, and so at what point did you get approached for an exit? Or did the government come to you and say, hey?
No, but we did. Well, we realized that we had sort of pivoted our way out of our competency, right? I understood privacy. I understood consumer things. I understood human rights groups that were using my platform, but I had no background.
Dark web spycraft, and suddenly it's like, uh-oh.
Yeah, right. I don't know who they are. I don't understand their how they think about threats. I don't really understand how they purchase, where the guardrails are around what they're allowed to do. So we ended up going out in about, I think it was 2006, sort of went out on a dog, you know, on a roadshow to sell the company to an acquirer. But we weren't happy with the numbers we got. You know, the valuations weren't there. We'd only been doing this for a couple of years. And so we pulled back and proved out another 2 years of hockey stick, went back out to the market and got a valuation that we were really happy with. And so we were able, and we could do that because we built the business in a way that led us, right? So we exited with zero debt and 10 million cash in the bank.
Wow.
Right. And that puts you in the catbird seat. You can really say no to people.
Yeah. Well, and then, so you're looking at from the time you started to the time you started thinking about exiting, 10 years.
Yeah, more or less 10, total 13 end to end.
And how many employees was the company running when you started to look for exit?
I think when we started to look for exit, we were probably 30 or 40.
Yeah. So were there challenges going from you to your first 5 to your first 20 employees? Or was it a pretty natural outgrowth and that's a small enough team, it was easy for you to manage? And the reason I say that is I work with a lot of people and they'll get their businesses up to the point where they've got about 4 or 5 employees, but they get stuck there and it doesn't seem they're able to ever kind of get past that.
Yeah, I mean, there's some big transformations. I always feel like 10 is one of those spots that there's a huge change, but probably even at 5. So at 3 or 4, you can all be in the same room at the same time all the time,
yeah,
or live in the same Slack channel or, you know, whatever you're doing virtually, but fundamentally in continuous communication, you're operating as one hive mind. You start to go up to 10. Now you have a little bit of specialization. You've got some people working in customer support. You've got like a graphics person, what have you. And then as you go past 10, I find you really are needing to start thinking about actual structure in the business, and you need to have management. Everyone can't report to the CEO anymore, and you're needing to start to think about hiring, you know, having people report to you who will have people report to them, and transmitting culture in that way, getting those information flows to work effectively in the company. That was a challenge for me, and I didn't have a lot of models to work from. You know, my resume is really short. I had goofy jobs in high school, a goofy job in college. I was a TA in grad school, and I was CEO of my own company, right? That's the whole resume. So I hadn't worked for a bunch of people who I could emulate, either in a good or bad way to, you know, like avoid the stupid things they'd done. I had very little sort of management model. So I made a real academic, I'm an academic, I made an academic study of that, to really focus on how does management work? How do you work with these people? How do you take care of that? And then eventually I brought in someone to actually be CEO, really run the business side of things, run the marketing, so I could stay focused on the customers, the sales, and the technology. And that worked out really well, especially that I brought this person in, because that allowed us to have kind of a good working relationship, as opposed to the situations where a board of directors brings someone in, that rarely works out well for the founder.
I mean, so was there a moment where you've spent a decade working for like high level privacy, and then Facebook comes out and just like everybody's like, I give you all my information for free.
That was, I think, one of the reasons why we were looking at that pivot and really did walk away from the consumer space was exactly, people would say, I want to be anonymous or private on the internet while using Facebook. It's like, I understand all of those words individually, but this sentence doesn't make any sense to me. And people don't want to really think about what that involves. Where, when I think about privacy, at the end of the day, if you don't want to just be a hermit in the woods and disconnect entirely, you sort of just need to segment your life to say, okay, this box is the things that I care about being private, and they will never be on social media, they will never be out there. And this box, I'm going to give up on. And it's out there, and you just need to pick and choose and pay attention to what you're protecting. Because if you think you're protecting everything, you're protecting nothing.
That's fascinating. So, where did you go after you exited? Did you take some time off for a year? Did you immediately go build a new thing,
I
or
didn't actually. So I
you
had
weren't
golden
finished your
handcuffs.
PhD?
I had golden handcuffs like you do. So I had a 2-year commitment to work with the acquiring company. And they were relatively small and they did know this space. So the entire C-suite were former senior CIA operations people, right? If there's an interesting hotspot in the world, one of them had been CIA chief of station in that place, so they knew it, but they didn't have a lot of technical bench, and they'd done a little bit of acquisitions around that space. But I was able to come in, and they really needed and appreciated the tech that I was bringing. And then they brought all this institutional knowledge to it. So I ended up sort of being a chief scientist for the company and working with them very, very closely, and stayed on way longer than I'd ever planned to, just because the stuff you're doing is so much fun, right? You're building tools that are like sticking a sharp stick in the eye of the Chinese and Russian intelligence agencies. Right, that's your opponent in these situations. That's really cool stuff. And they
All right,
treated me too well to leave as
I'm going to
well.
say, be honest, how many stories did they share with you that you can't share publicly?
Lots, lots. I mean, by the time the acquisition happened, I already had a beyond regular top secret clearance. So, you couldn't even talk to these people about requirements without the highest level of clearances, because they needed to be able to sort of open the book and show you exactly what they're doing so you could
See,
deliver
your
something.
wife needs to write a fiction series of thrillers that's totally fiction, but it just so happens that a lot of those stories are match up with certain things. See,
Right.
you've got the next
Gotta
five book
walk that
series.
line real carefully as you go down. But I stayed with them actually until 2020, which is crazy, right? I stayed on for 12 years, but within a couple of years, I moved out to wine country because that's where I wanted to be, and they were perfectly happy to have me telecommute as chief scientist. I was the face of the company because CIA people don't like to be on camera, and having a blast. So it was really, really difficult to finally extract myself.
You were trendsetting for decades. You were doing privacy before people knew what privacy was. You were teleworking before people knew what that was. And then you retire, and then suddenly the world's like, oh, there's this thing called teleworking.
Right, exactly. Yeah, right. I quit January 1st of 2020, right as we go into COVID. It was interesting timing. But I'd really gotten active in angel investing and advising before that. As soon as I moved out here, I joined a group called the North Bay Angels. Pretty quickly, I was on the board of directors. I've been running their selection committee for many years, so I got to see a huge number of startups, but also really see the mistakes they were making. And so that led me to want to help them do this better, because it's really frustrating to see a company that's not going to get funded, not because it isn't a good idea or doesn't have a good market, but because they don't know how to talk about it. They don't know how to frame it. They're focusing on the wrong things, or they've just forgotten to validate some important things that they could go do in a week with $200, but they haven't done it.
Well, now you could do it in 30 minutes in ChatGPT.
Potentially, although I want to see where the rubber meets the road, especially if it's an original idea,
So
right?
let's talk about that then. So this is fascinating because you started, you've gone through these, you went through an exit, you stayed on a lot longer. Most people stay on their 2 years and they're peace out. And the fact that you created a scenario that made it enjoyable to keep working is fantastic. So what are there, have you categorized like the mistakes? Is it like, is there 90% of startups make the same like five mistakes over and over again?
I would say, yeah, certainly among technical founders, they are in love with their technical solution, and that's their comfort zone, right? As when you're a developer, what you're comfortable doing is being behind the screen, building these things out. And so they tend to build way, way too early. And then they have a solution in search of a problem, right? They're now trying to work out how does this thing fit into the world, as opposed to getting out and talking to customers at the very beginning of things, understanding where are the pain points, how bad is this problem? Is it another thing is founders get happy ears. They'll talk to someone and say, would this be useful to you? Would this be better than what you're doing now? And people are like, yeah. And they think, great, validation. But it isn't a lot better. And these people have 100 things that are causing their businesses to burn down or their lives are in chaos. They're going to solve those 100 other problems first. Your problem just isn't a big enough priority. And so that's a mistake I think a lot of people have is in looking at that competitive landscape. It isn't their precise exact competitors. It is every other way that problem can be solved and every other problem that's a higher priority to your customers.
Wow.
And you need to be at the top of that list.
So that's one of the, it's interesting to say that. It was maybe a year or two ago, I read about, was at the time, it was kind of a big deal that the founder of DoorDash forced all of his programmers to take an 8-hour shift answering customer support tickets once a month. And they like revolted, and something like 30% of the programmers quit because they were like, that's not my job. But his whole point was, you guys are programming this thing and creating problems, and you're not talking to the people about the problems you're creating. And then once they did that, like the whole company took off because suddenly the programmers were like, oh, well, I didn't understand that that would be a problem for a non-programming person, right?
That's
So.
right. You're right. This is obvious to me. Why isn't it obvious to them? Of course you should, just try this or click around until you find the right answer. But normal people don't do that. Exactly.
So what would be the ideal sort of scenario for you if, let's say you go back, you're yourself 20 years ago starting now, like what would you do to get a startup off the ground and going?
Yeah, I mean, certainly back then it was a whole different world.
Sure. I'm talking about you then, but today,
But today,
with your
yeah,
knowledge.
so definitely I'd be spending a lot more time starting with the problem. I think I see way too many people try to navel gaze their way to the right problem, whereas the good startups that I see typically come out of firsthand experience. Someone who's been in that world, who's tried to do something, has seen the problem and has tried to solve it in other ways and knows that there's not a problem. So I'm always looking for those kinds of solutions. I do a lot more research. I was the classic sit behind the keyboard and build things and not talk to anyone. I am the hardest of hardcore nerds at heart, and pivoting to be outward facing and public speaking and all of that was a very long journey to get comfortable and good with that. But that would have made immense difference. I mean, one of the versions of my product, I built this amazing tool for privacy that had so much nuance and allowed such fine grained control over everything. And not only did my customers absolutely hate that user interface and never used it, I didn't even use that user interface once I had it. I discovered like, oh my God, I'm spending all my time managing all these settings. And so the next version of our product, 180 degrees, it was an on-off button. You want privacy? No privacy. Click. Everyone loved that, right? It fit with the level of engagement they wanted to have with the solution. Maybe if I talked to some people, I could have skipped that entire development cycle.
So, at what point of this, your journey, did you the idea for Feel the Boot come along, and what's the history behind the name?
So, I've been advising people. I guess I've been pretty actively advising people from maybe 2015 is when I started getting pretty active in that space. And around 2019, I was realizing that that doesn't scale. And I wanted to be able to build out something that could have far more impact than the handful of people I could really handle on a one-to-one ongoing basis. And so I was thinking about names. And I realized that a couple of people that I was advising that knew each other had spontaneously started referring to me as the boot. Like, oh, I got to talk to the boot. I need to go get the boot again. I need some help with this
The
thing.
boot, because you're going to kick him in the butt.
I'm going to kick him in the butt. I'm going to get a little motivational kick in the ass here. I'm going to push him, out of their comfort zone. And so I had a lot of ideas that were much more flowery or much more technical or much more professional sounding, but I don't know. I just kind of keep coming back to that as sort of the authentic truth of what I'm delivering. And so Feel the Boot ended up as the name of the YouTube channel and blog and all of the free content that I was putting out.
So, what are some of the topics you cover in Feel the Boot? I think you were saying, we were talking earlier, you have 115 episodes.
Yeah, 116 full length and 90 some shorts. So I'd say probably a good fraction of them are around fundraising because that seems to be the thing that most people ask about. And I think that is because it's the first time that founders seriously hit a brick wall, that they can kind of muck their way through hiring some people. Maybe they suck at management, but they can make people do things. They can buy some ads on Facebook or hire someone on Fiverr to do something. But fundraising, they go out, they talk to 30 or 40 people, and they're getting crickets back. And okay, how do you overcome that? How do you get there? So I've got a lot talking about that whole fundraising process. And of course, as an active angel, I understand a lot about that from the other side of the table. But then a lot talking about how to get your startup going, how to think about validating your ideas, how to find good ideas to work with, how to motivate your employees, how to put together an advisory board, how to pull together a board of directors for the company. So it really does cover the whole gambit
Wow.
from the very first idea stages through, and usually I'm targeting people up through maybe their A round. By the time they get past that, they really have now a large group of professionals who are helping them.
Yeah.
And so that's less interesting to me. Plus,
You've
I really
essentially
love that
created
phase
a
when everything's being created, right? When they're building things from scratch and discovering what the business is, that's fun.
That's your, yeah. Well, so you've essentially created a PhD for startups, if you just put it online for free.
Something like that. But, and then I started doing advising and, opening up office hours because even when you try to explain everything, every startup is unique, right? There's always going to be individual inflections. So people will try to take the advice and instructions, and as clear as I try to make them, they still struggle with, okay, what does that mean in my case? How do I find this thing? And so I started then providing some one-on-one coaching with them. But of course, that doesn't scale that well either.
What so being on both sides of this, like are where we're at right now, the beginning of 2025, are you seeing like a couple of like is there two or three things that is like the hot thing that's coming up right now? Like, 2007, 8 to 2015, social media was everybody was trying to do social media. Right now we've obviously AI is like the big thing. Is there a couple of in niches or industries of things that are happening in the startup space that haven't quite gotten really big yet, but you think are going to?
AI is really taking all the oxygen right now. It was for a while blockchain, and I'm still seeing a fair amount of blockchain stuff going on, but the level of land rush into AI is unprecedented. And it makes sense, right? The rapidity with which AI is getting adopted across all sorts of things is fascinating. But like with many of these land rushes, there's an enormous amount of snake oil as well, right? As a lot of people look and go, oh, AI is the current hotness. Let me start an AI company. As opposed to, I understand some fundamental need that AI would let me address, that I can leverage that, Or I see people trying to advertise their business as an AI business when they're a business that happens to leverage AI. And it kind of reminds me of like the late 90s when people were like, hey, we're going to do our thing with a website. I'm like, okay. Everyone is doing it with a website. That has ceased to be a differentiator. Saying I use AI is like, well, okay, you're not an idiot. Everyone's using AI. If you don't, you're getting left behind. But is there something unique you're doing about it? Otherwise, you don't even need to talk about it. Like, it goes without saying.
It's funny because, you know, my part of my business is people hire me to help them write and publish books. And one of the things that I tell people now is they're like, I'm going to have a book. And I was like, having a book now is kind of like saying you have a website in 2010, right? And we're just to the point where it's standard, like you have to have, that's like the foundational entry point to working. And that was kind of driven home. I was working with a guy who he just got his PhD from, I want to say Columbia, and it was in crisis leadership. And it was funny because he was just finishing up his thesis. I think he argued his thesis in February of 2020. So you got real world experience there, but he came to me and he's like, I need a book. And I'm like, why do you need a book? He's like, I need credibility. I was like, you have a PhD from Columbia. And he's like, oh yeah, but in my field, like PhD opens the door and then the book is a differentiator once I get inside the room, which I always thought was so fascinating.
It is funny though. People take having a book really, really seriously. It's this imprint, even if it's self-published, even if it's crap, somehow saying published author of.
I heard a marketer one time who said that a book was the only remaining low dollar item that still had a very high value perception. And I was like, that's actually true, because it, for most people, it, you know, even without AI, like even with AI, you're still looking at 15, 20 hours of time to try to organize this thing. And that's the, I think also the big differentiator though, too, is like, because AI is becoming so prevalent, if you're articulate and can form your own thing, you just sound so much more natural. You'll immediately like start stepping your way out of the top.
Right, right. Yeah, the AI is always going to have that slightly AI sound. But also, of course, it's never going to be truly original. And yeah. So if you want to say something that hasn't been said before, AI is not going to give it to you because it's only giving you things it's been trained with.
There's a programmer who right now he's in the marketing space. He's probably the second most well-known guy in the world, expert on AI integration and everything. And somebody, he does open office hours, and somebody asked him like, how do I get an advantage in the age of AI? That's what he called it. And he laughed and he said, I guess we are kind of, that's what we'll look at the next day. Like we were just in the information age and now we're in the age of AI. And he said, your biggest advantage in the age of AI will be to become more human. And everybody was blown away because this guy uses AI for everything. And he was like, that's your big differentiator. He's like, because more and more people are becoming less and less human and outsourcing more and more to AI without developing critical thinking skills and all that sort of stuff. So anyway, I'm going off a little bit topic there. So you do the coaching, you also do an incubator. Let's talk a little bit about that. And we were talking before, like that incubator has evolved into the new program that even hasn't launched yet. By the time this comes out, we'll probably be close there, but.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So I'm really moving from this ad hoc coaching model and taking a lot of this knowledge that I've been building, you know, and building this, writing this book was a lot of distilling my thinking about this down into a more systematized way. How do you launch a company? How do you get it funded? How do you build this out? And so being the deep down nerd that I am, I've created a program called Founder Quest. So following that quest from hitting the crossroads, I want to kind of leave my former life behind and set off on this mission to build this company through discovering your unicorn status and becoming a billion-dollar company. What does that look like? And the core of that, at least the first core, because I've got a number of modules I want to build out, is the Funded Founder Framework to help people go through that in a really step-by-step systematized way to look at getting their company ready to raise, putting together that pitch, doing their outreach, and you know, closing the deals with the investors.
Is that your first book, The Funded Founder?
The Funded Founder Framework, yeah, will be the first book that comes out. It's in advanced beta, so it'll definitely be out this year, but maybe not by the time this episode comes out.
Sure. So if somebody's out there, they've been thinking about going down the founder journey, or they're in startup mode right now, like how can they find more about you? How can they get involved with what you have going on?
So definitely reach out, connect on LinkedIn. That's probably the easiest place to find me. You can also get more information and tons of free content at feeltheboot.com or YouTube. It's Feel the Boot. Also TikTok, which is now back on, is Feel the Boot. All these different platforms. That's a great place to start. And then very soon, founderquest.com will be up and running. And that's where I'm creating a community focused around this. It'll be a subscription program that gives access to all of my sort of organized and structured trainings around this
Love
process.
it. All right, final question. You and I, we meet in LA. You tell me what you do, and you're an angel investor. And I'm like, that's so interesting. I've had this idea for a startup for years, but just wasn't sure what to do or where to start. What advice would you give?
Validate. What have you done to test out this thing, right? I want to know that you've interviewed customers, that you've really researched hard potential competitors, what other options are out there. Is this a big enough problem? Is the market big enough? Do people really, really want this? And one thing people don't look at is they'll often Google for other companies doing what they're doing. They need to go and dig up bodies in the graveyards. Right. There's often dozens of companies that have started to do this, got a little bit of funding, got, $50,000, $100,000 in revenue, then failed. You need to go to school on that. Do some forensics on those bodies to understand why is the road littered with these corpses. I'm going to make a gruesome analogy. And what can you do to avoid those outcomes? Really understand where they went wrong and make sure you actually do have a distinct insight and advantage over the approaches they've taken.
That's a good idea for your next book, The Startup Graveyard. And you can analyze well-known startups that collapsed, and you can talk about what made them not succeed.
It's an advanced startup necromancy. Go speak with dead.
Well, Lance, thank you so much for your time. This has been super fascinating. I appreciate it.
Awesome. Thanks so much. This is fun.
Take care.